listening to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When it comes to resource development, can we really go gentle into that dark night? There are a number of scientists who say we can, and they've dedicated their careers to helping us find better ways to work with the environment, rather than trying to overpower and destroy it. Christian Messier of the Sustainable Forest Management Network looks at a new concept called the triad approach. Simon Dyer documents the negative impact of well sites and roads on an already dwindling population of woodland caribou. And Nat Rutter looks back to the legacy of the Arctic Summer School, a University of Alberta extension program in the 1970s, when the Berger Inquiry into Northern Development made everyone take notice of the clash between exploration, environment, and culture. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. How we view the forest and the way we log it has undergone an overwhelming transformation over the last decade. We've moved beyond the simplistic paradigm of fiber extraction into the more complex world of ecosystem management. And even that has morphed into something else called the triad approach. I asked Dr. Christian Messier of the Sustainable Forest Management Network to explain this new perspective.
The triad is actually a zoning strategy in forestries that has been suggested by some Americans some 30 years ago that hasn't really been applied yet. But I think now there is more and more interest for this idea of zoning. So the zoning strategy is actually quite simple. We want to continue get fiber and timber and other resources from the forest. But now we are actually under a lot of pressure to protect biodiversity. And most governments have actually signed the Rio Accord about protecting the biodiversity. And I think in many cases, often they don't know. How could we protect biodiversity while at the same time continuing taking a big, big, big chunk of the forest in terms of timber and fiber? So the triad is, I think, a solution that can actually satisfy everybody. And that is what I think is appealing for me. Because when we talk about the triad, we talk about three different scenarios. One is conservation. We need to have areas in our forest that are protected in an integral way where we don't use any resource. And there's lots of pressure in different parts of the country to increase the proportion of the land that is protected. In Quebec, for example, we protect less than 2% of our land. And I think that we would like to have at least 8, 12, and myself, I would like to see up to 25% being protected. But when we protect land, it means less timber, which means some factories being closed, and it means a loss of jobs. So the triad is a way to make this conservation effort possible by taking the timber in other ways, which is the other part of the triad is intensive forestry.
What do you mean by intensive?
In the natural forests, in most of the boreal forests of Canada, in the natural system, a forest will produce will increase the volume by 1 cubic meter per hectare per year. Maybe it doesn't mean much for most people, but let's keep this number, 1 cubic meter per hectare per year. This is a good number. Now, we know now, because lots of countries are doing it and we are starting to do it, that if we take some piece of land that are fairly rich, if we use either native species or hybrid species, we can produce 5 times, 10 times, and up to 15 times more cubic meter per hectare per year. So the same hectare can produce up to 15 cubic meter per hectare per year, which means that if we do intensive forestry on 1 hectare, we can preserve 15 hectares because we will replace, we could actually get our fiber needs from 1 hectare instead of 15 hectares of a natural forest. This is what I mean by intensive forestry. And how do we do this? We do that by planting the trees, by eliminating all the competition, by doing some genetic improvement, by even using hybrid. Hybrids are a mixture of species that give us some properties that are more interesting, and the properties that are interesting for us is to grow fast. And for example, in poplar, we have hybrid poplars that can grow extremely fast. And we can also fertilize. So there's many, many different means we can use to do intensive forestry. And this is well known. This has been applied very intensively in Finland and Sweden, for example.
Now, that sounds more like plantation-type tree farming or logging. And that's the sort of thing that really gets the hackles up of people who are concerned about the environment. Would this be done in the forest or on land that hasn't necessarily been forested or hasn't been forested for a long time?
Well, there's different options, and I think there's a need for research in this area. In Quebec, for example, we have around 500,000 hectares in the southern part of Quebec that has been abandoned in the last 50 years for agricultural purposes because the soil is very rich, but it has big rocks, and agriculture is so mechanized right now that these big machines don't like these big rocks. But these soils are very rich and can grow trees very well. And right now what we have is we have degraded vegetation and shrubs, and it doesn't produce much. So I think one objective of this triad is to actually use these lands and grow trees. But your question is very good. Is most of the bad publicity and most of the things that people don't like about forestry is these plantation, these intensive forestry. And there's a bit of a contradiction. But I think this is the interesting idea with the triad is actually we will use something that is totally unnatural, plantation, but it's like agriculture. When we grow corn or we grow wheat, there's nothing natural about it. But we can grow trees like a crop and produce lots of this fiber, and this will reduce the need, the pressure in our natural forest.
Where does that come in then? Because what we've talked about, the one prong being leaving everything for natural and in protected areas. On the other hand, you have the intensive agricultural approach. So what's the third part?
Yeah, the third part is there's many names. There's ecological forestry, extensive forestry, ecosystem management that wants to emulate natural disturbance. And this third part is also called gentle forestry. So it's forestry where we harvest some of the timber, but we actually do it in a way where we protect biodiversity, we protect habitats. And there's lots of good examples now starting to be implemented in various parts of Canada. For example, we instead of doing clear cuts where we remove 100% of the trees, we may actually leave 5, 10, 20% of the trees. And these trees will never be harvested because they will produce or they will be left there to produce what we call biological legacies for species to use, cavity nesters, different insects that needs decaying wood, etc. And also, we also could harvest this forest, but not on a 50, 60, or 100 years rotation, but maybe in some cases on a 200 years rotation, so that we actually will recreate some what we call mature forest and old growth forest. But all of these things, what they mean is less fiber. And in many parts of Canada, we are already limited in fiber. So the companies, the government, because it means loss of jobs and small communities, are not willing to accept this gentle forestry or even increase conservation because we lack fiber. And the idea of the triad is to recover this by putting 5, 10, 15% of the land into intensive forestry. And we've done some calculation, and it's possible to put 10% of the land under intensive forestry and have enough timber to do gentle forestry on 70% of the land and maybe get 15, 20% of the land under conservation. So it's possible. I think what is lacking, as I always say, it's political will.
What research is underway that is looking at how this would actually come together and whether it is any good? It seems theoretically to be very good, but what is actually going to happen?
Well, there's actually very few research done on this because this is a new concept, and I think it took a while to get people accepted this, but there's actually a lot of proposal. I have actually a proposal to work on this. And what we want to do is really use this new science of landscape ecology where we could actually use satellite imageries. We can use the new models that are being developed and look at big regions where are the forests that are the best forests that we should protect? How big the protected area should be protected so that we maintain the natural process? And this is very important because in our boreal forest, one of the main disturbances is fire, and fire that will burn huge areas. So if we want to protect an area where we allow natural process to occur, we have to protect huge piece of land to allow the fire to come, and it won't burn all of the protected area. So we need huge areas. And then we can actually use these new technologies to identify where are the sites that has actually where the soil is the best, and where will we put these intensive forestry in relation to the mills, close to the roads. And in a way, this is a study to see how we could disperse the tree zoning, the intensive, the protected, and the gentle forestry together to maximize the protection of the biodiversity and maximize the timber production and minimize the cost. So it requires what I call this new science of landscape ecology, and we have the tools now, and we have a project that will be underway, I hope, in the next few months in Quebec.
As a scientist, how are you approaching this problem?
Well, this is actually an interesting question because 5 years ago I was against intensive forestry. I was against plantation. I was doing a lot of research on natural regeneration, and I was focusing mainly on the gentle forestry side. I thought that we in Canada, we have lots of land and we should not go the intensive way, but we should go the gentle way. And so a few years ago when I changed and I started to promote intensive forestry, a lot of people have asked me, what's happening with you, Christian? Why are you changing your mind like that? And I have to say that this is probably part of this experience working with the Sustainable Forest Management Network, interacting with social scientists, with Aboriginal, with industry people, and realizing that the gentle forestry or the ecological forestry is a good idea. But to implement it the way I wanted to implement it, it will have mean closing factories, losing jobs. And I realized that this was not socially acceptable. So I accepted the fact that I was responsible to find a solution, because I still believe that ecological forestry is a good way. So I was responsible to find a solution. And I think when I heard and read about the triad approach, I thought this was a very reasonable way to do the research. And the way I approach it is to get actually the best people that I know in this field working together in an integrated way with the partners, with the public, with the environmentalists, and put a lot of pressure on the government, because the government is always very reluctant to change. And I think that by having a coalition of scientists, industrial partners, environmentalists, and being as public as possible, I mean, really go and talk to the public, explain to the public what we are trying to do, I think that we can succeed. So research, yes, but a lot of communication with the public and interdisciplinary work, and doing that in a very open and in a collaborative way. I think this is, my approach to find solutions that are acceptable for everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was speaking with Dr. Christian Messier. He's a professor of forest ecology at the University of Quebec, and his research is supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is hosted at the University of Alberta. This year marks the 90th anniversary of the Faculty of Extension at the University of Alberta. The idea of reaching beyond the classroom of the university to the community abroad was first embraced by Dr. Henry Marshall Torrey. And from the very first traveling lectures and lantern shows of 1912, extension programs have always sought to meet the public needs of the time. Such is the case of Extension's Arctic Summer School. It ran during the 1970s at a time when everyone's attention turned north. Geologist Dr. Nat Rutter looks back at his involvement in this groundbreaking extension program.
You know, the Arctic Summer School, really there was a the reason it began was because there was a strong desire for many people in industry and education as well as government to know more about the Canadian Arctic because of the amount of exploration and development in the north. People just needed to know more to make the proper decisions. And so what we try to do then in this Arctic Summit is we'll give them a broad picture from the social end of the north as well as the natural science end. And so to this end, we developed our curriculum around these ideas.
What were some of the things that you were involved in?
Well, because I was a surficial geologist or a quaternary geologist, which is really the study of the Earth for the last 2.5 million years, they wanted me to give an explanation on how the landforms, the latest landforms in the Arctic formed, as well as the kind of materials that were that they consisted of, as well as the different construction methods needed to work in this terrain. This included, of course, the permafrost, which is the permanently frozen ground you find up there, and also the history of the glaciation and how and when and how this developed. So really it was the natural science from a geological point of view.
Who would come?
Well, we had all kinds of people. We had everything from young engineers that were hired by companies in Calgary or in Edmonton. We had geotechnical engineers that were newly hired, as well as some very senior people. I think of the publisher of the Edmonton Journal that came with us one year because of the amount of information that was being published in his paper, the Edmonton Journal, that he thought he ought to be on the ground and see what was going on up there. So it was really a diversity of people.
What kinds of things would you do?
Yeah, well, there was really a variety of things. It was certainly one thing I can say. It was really field-oriented. Sure, we had lectures by local experts in classrooms, but really the idea was to get out and really look at what's going on up there. And one of the trips that was probably the most popular was the open boat trip from down the Mackenzie River down into the Mackenzie Delta from Inuvik. And this was very popular. This is where we'd look at the geology as well as the botany and other aspects of that area. And also there was a reindeer farm, if you guess you'd call it a farm, up in that area, and we'd ask the owners about that. So that was a highlight. But there were other trips also that were interesting, going into some of the native villages and talking to those people. And just various aspects of the North.
What brought it to an end?
Well, really what brought it to an end is after the Berger Inquiry and the shutdown of a potential pipeline, there was a loss of interest in that region just from Arctic drilling to exploration in general. And, of course, the pipeline, which was on hold for at least 10 years, just brought activity to a halt. And all of a sudden, a lot of these people were no longer interested or as a primarily interested in the North. So it just fewer and fewer people enrolled for the course. And for a while there, we were turning people away. It was so popular.
What was it like for the people who were coming up there from the time when they first came and then when they were finished the school?
I think really it was a surprise, the complexity of the social and economic and natural side of the North. There's an awful lot of aspects and a lot of parameters to consider when you're making decisions. So I think it was really an eye-opener to an awful lot of people. It wasn't to me in the beginning also, and anybody from, say, Toronto, we all use Toronto as an example, but anybody living in Toronto going up there for the first time, it was just an unbelievable experience for them. And, of course, such things as having daylight 23 hours out of the day was something most of them have never experienced before. But I think it's the interaction of the people, as far as First Nations people, as well as whites that have and others who have worked up there, and the problems they have dealing with various aspects of life was an eye-opener. Because the population, as you know, is so sparse that just the transportation from one community to another is a major effort in this sort of thing.
What would you try and get across to people? What was your message to them?
my message to him was that, well, I had my own agenda, of course, and my message to him that any time you disturb the surface in the Arctic, that you have an added problem with the presence or absence of permafrost, and therefore my message was that all construction activities, be it a road, be it houses, had to be done in a different way. And so this was my message to him, because really, up until this time, engineers were using southern methods to build much of the highways. For example, instead of building a gully next to a road for drainage like you do down here, in an area of continuous permafrost, you try to protect the permafrost. And the last thing you want to do is gully along the road. You want to equalize drainage, not try to drainage away. When I say equalize, I mean culverts across the highway so you don't disturb the permafrost. In other words, you don't want to melt the permafrost, because that's really your base. That's just one example. So my message was to educate people on the problems and the conditions and the environment of the North.
There's so much planned activity now that it looks like everything you dealt with in the 70s is starting to come around again. What can you say from that time that could apply to this time?
Well, one thing that it kind of amuses me, a lot of the work that was done by the federal government and other governments during the late 60s and the early 70s, there was an awful lot of money that went in there, and all that information was published. A lot of it, most of it was published, and therefore that information is available. And I see now that with this renewed activity up there, that all this work is being consulted with. Sure, they're adding details, but a lot of that original work is used and is useful for what's happening up there now. But you're right, it's kind of coming around again. But I guess we all know that there is a cycle that seems to be working in many directions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nat Rutter is a university professor emeritus in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Alberta. He's also an associate dean of science, and he was a participant in the Faculty of Extension's Arctic Summer School during the 1970s. The resource boom in Alberta's north is having an impact on boreal wildlife, and one species of particular concern is the threatened woodland caribou. Woodland caribou live among the black spruce and peatlands, and they're quite sensitive to human disturbance of their habitat. To what extent has been the research focus of biologist Simon Dyer?
I conducted this research with the Boreal Caribou Committee and the Boreal Caribou Research Program. My study focused on seeing how woodland caribou responded to industrial activity, primarily the effects of roads, seismic lines, and well sites. Basically, what we did was put radio collars, satellite radio collars, on caribou and then track their movements.
How long a period did you have to track them?
We put the collars on for a two-year period, and so collected a vast amount of data, hundreds of thousands of caribou locations.
Now how would you collect that?
Well, it's a pretty interesting process, actually. The GPS collar collects the location, and then we're able to fly and basically use a modem to telephone the collar and then download the locations and then go back to the office and plot them on computer maps. And from there, the real fun, the analysis, starts.
What are you looking for when you're doing this analysis?
Well, I had two main hypotheses. Firstly, I wanted to see whether caribou avoided human infrastructure. And then secondly, I wanted to see whether these linear features, roads and seismic lines, acted as barriers to caribou movements.
And what did you find out?
Well, it was quite interesting. We found that woodland caribou avoid roads, well sites, and seismic lines in their ranges. Now, we're not talking about total avoidance here, but if you looked at a zone of influence from 100 meters to 500 meters away from some of these features, you'd find that caribou use these areas much less than you'd expect by chance. For seismic lines, for instance, in late winter, they used areas within 250 meters of them, only about as 60% as much as expected.
Why do you think that they avoid areas where there's human activity?
Well, there's a few hypotheses about that. It could be they associate it with some sort of predation risk, then maybe they've been hunted before from these features, and so they avoid them. Another interesting suggestion is that wolves actually preferentially travel on these lines, and as such, the lines represent a place where caribou don't want to be, so they avoid them as well.
What's the concern, then, with the caribou and the activity that you would want to study it?
Well, there's a couple of issues. The avoidance is important for a number of reasons. Firstly, if caribou are avoiding areas, it means the effective habitat they're using is reduced, and that has implications on caribou populations. The second issue, this issue of barriers, we found that caribou cross roads six times less than we'd expect by chance. So in a similar way, you find caribou being constrained into smaller areas. Also, this makes them, we think, more predictable in space and time, and that might make it easier for their predators to find them as well.
What are the implications of this, then?
Well, there's a few implications. If we're going to continue with resource extraction in northern Alberta, we need to make sure we minimize any way we can the influence on caribou habitat. So a few things that come to mind, we can minimize our road networks by joint infrastructure planning between industries. We can minimize the effect on seismic lines by cutting narrower lines. I should say seismic lines I used in my study were generally 5 meters or more in width. So we don't know the effect on these narrower, low-impact lines less than 2 meters in width. It's hoped that they have less effect on caribou, and research at the University of Alberta is addressing that now.
It's one thing to find out the information, but how do you get it applied in an industrial setting? People are out there, they're setting up their well sites, they're doing their seismic. You still have to get them to come along with your ideas.
Yeah, well, there are guidelines for resource extraction in caribou habitat, and government and industry sit down to develop guidelines, and the Boreal Coordinating Committee produces a set of guidelines for operations in caribou zone. So it's a good way to actually use research and take it to the decision makers and the managers and say, look, here are some things you can change and improve things for caribou. So not doing the research is only half of the job. It's important to communicate the information to decision makers.
Now that your report's been published, where is it? Is that something that people can get hold of and read?
Sure. It's published in the July issue of the Canadian Journal of Zoology, and it's accessible in university libraries and on the internet at the National Science and Engineering Research Council website.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Simon Dyer is presently a forest ecologist at Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. His co-authors on the Woodland Caribou Avoidance Study were Stan Booten, Jack O'Neill, and Sean Wassel. Simon's work was also recognized by the Alberta Society of Biologists with the Peggy Thompson Award for Best Publication in 2001. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can also subscribe to the weekly Innovation Alberta newsletter. The program is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Conservation Association, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.